Welcome to the A-Dub Club, a podcast about sci-fi, fantasy, technology, pop culture, the internet, and general nerdery. There are three things that are important to know. One, we occasionally use swear words, but try to stay in the range of PG-13, or at least the kind of R the cool parents are fine with. Two, we may talk spoilers. In this particular episode, we discuss the movie Howl's Moving Castle, as well as most other movies from Hayao Miyazaki, so be warned. And finally, three, most importantly, Miyazaki was inspired to make Spirited Away because he wanted to make a movie with a 10-year-old girl as the hero as an inspiration for the kids of his family friends. With that out of the way, welcome to the clubhouse. We have snacks. Welcome to the A-Dub Club. My name is Andrew Whipple.
I'm Alex Wade.
Here we are back in the quarantine once more. And I know we had mentioned before that we'll probably do another Buffy-related episode as you watch through the rest of the series. But now I demand that we have to do it, if only so I have another excuse to use the Buffy version of the A-Dub Club that I spent much more time than I should have putting together.
That was amazing, by the way. I forgot to mention that. That was...
Thank you.
When I first started listening to it, I thought for some reason it was like, why is he using the Doctor Who except in 8-bit? And then I realized, oh no, of course he's not. He's doing the...
It was cool. Yep. It was cool. Do you appreciate how organically I brought in that excuse to brag about a thing that I did?
Good job.
It was great. But that is for the future at some point when I decide to... when Alex Wade watches more Buffy and I probably end up rewatching the whole show. But this time, We're talking about something else here in our pandemic hellscape.
Yeah. This time we're talking about your favorite, and I say you're the audience's favorite because it's everyone's favorite, animated director, Miyazaki. And we are going to be doing a movie review of Howl's Moving Castle, which is, I believe, I just Googled this recently, the 2004 release of the dubbed American version was what I watched, at least.
Nice. Oh, God, I need to remember because it was 2 weeks ago. I think I watched the subtitled version.
In Japanese?
In Japanese, but with subtitles.
Really?
But I don't remember.
Do you remember Billy Crystal?
Oh, yes. In fact, I remember that I heard that Billy Crystal was the guy that did the voice, and I was bummed out that I watched the subs instead of the dub because I didn't hear Billy Crystal. I watched some clips of him on YouTube, but yes. So yeah, for this one, I definitely watched the subbed version.
Oh, that's rough. Honestly, like, I would recommend rewatching it.
Yeah. I guess this is maybe as good a time as any to get into, like, general Miyazaki overall and how we feel about him as a director and as a force in our own consumption lives. But generally... now, or at least in the last couple of years when I've watched them, I've tried to watch the sub version first and then switch over to the dub, maybe on a rewatch, something like that. I did not do that for some of the other movies that I watched this week. I think all the other ones I watched, I did the dub version instead. But yeah, for Howl and for some of the ones I'd seen before this week, I watched the subtitle version, which was good. I mean, I liked it. But yeah, the seeing the Billy Crystal of it all in particular, I was like, oh, that fits really well. That's a perfect fit for Calcifer.
Yes, that it was. He was a perfect fit for Calcifer. He was beautiful and amazing, and like he's one of my favorite parts of the film.
Yeah,
hands down. Which I'm a little upset still that you didn't get to see him.
Yeah, bummer. But on the whole subs for stubs question, what is we can maybe each go through what's our Miyazaki history? What have we seen?
Yeah.
How did he come into our lives? Is he a big deal in either of our movie consumption lives?
Sure. I would say for me, he's a very big deal. I started watching him at my friend Clayton's house in like fifth or fourth grade or something.
Shout out to Clayton.
Yeah, shout out to Clayton if you're listening. And he owned like a huge catalog, or I guess his family owned a huge catalog of the Miyazaki films, and we just loved watching them. They were great. They're beautiful and poignant and, usually full of action and, you know, fantasy, sci-fi, rigmarole, which is why I liked them originally. And then I eventually grew to love them for that, and also the story. Also, just the animation itself is beautiful. Like, the bacon, I just love the bacon, how they fried the bacon in Howl's Moving Castle.
I think this is... I think that there's an episode of the Binging with Babish YouTube show where this guy makes food from movies and TVs and tries to recreate them. I think he did an episode on that Baked Breakfast from Howl's Moving Castle.
Yeah. It's just a beautiful thing. And I've, over the years, I used to keep a digital movie collection of pirated and torrented stuff. And a huge catalog of that was just all of the different Miyazaki films. I think I've seen most of them. I think the ones I'm missing are, there's like A Leaf in the Wind or Soldier in the Wind or something.
The Wind Rises.
Yes, The Wind Rises. And then there's another one or two out there, I believe, that I'm missing. The Wind Rises isn't a fantasy one, right?
Yeah, no, it's a fictionalized version of the story of a guy who designed fighter planes for the Japanese in World War II.
Okay. Yeah, so I didn't watch that because it didn't really fit with my one thing that I used to, grow up really loving it was the fantasy and the sci-fi parts of it. And I'm like, I'm older now and I need to go out and watch that because it's, first off, one of the Miyazakis that I haven't watched, but I'm also like a little like bracing myself for the fact that it won't have that stuff in it.
Yeah, no spoilers. So that was one of the ones that I watched this week. First of all, it's fucking incredible. It's definitely, I think, one of my favorite of his.
Okay.
But no spoilers. But it does have that. Interesting. Well, it is a real story, or it's a fictionalized version of a real story that is like, it is not a fantasy story. However, there's some interesting stuff that happens in it, and I'm not going to say more than that. But there's Miyazaki plays with the idea of Miyazaki doing a realistic non-fantasy story in interesting ways.
Okay, interesting. I mean, I'm highly more encouraged now to see it because you said that.
Yeah, I definitely recommend it. What would you say your favorite Miyazaki movie is, if you have one?
Oh. That's a tough one. I mean, so before I just rewatched it, I would have said Howl's. And I think I think I'd still probably say Howl's just because of all of the whimsy that's in it. But I do have I don't know if I'm being like overly critical of the love story that's in there and the way how women are portrayed and some of the tropes they use. But besides that, I would still say Howl's is probably my favorite.
Okay. Nice. Nice. We'll get into that more as we discuss the movie more in depth. But
how about you?
For me, I think my favorite probably is Spirited Away. Though it's a close tie between that and Princess Mononoke, I think, for me.
Yeah. I want to take mine back. I want to tie it with Spirited Away.
Yeah.
Because the only thing with Spirited Away for me is the dubbed version. I remember the main character had this one scene that had a really whiny voice that just like grated my ears every time. And so that so totally scratched me off. And also I think I was a bit of like a Miyazaki hipster at the time.
Okay.
And was like, oh, everyone's seen Spirited Away. Like, that's not my favorite because I've seen more than just Spirited Away. Because it is absolutely, the most popular.
Yeah.
So it's definitely like the Hamlet of Miyazaki films. And
yes, I think that's a really good way to put it. It's the only one that he's ever won the animated feature Oscar for. It is, in fact, to this day, the highest grossing film in Japan.
Makes sense.
Has been ever since its release. I think the one that it beat, I don't remember if it beat Princess, I know Princess Mononoke was the highest grossing film in Japan, and I don't know if Spirited Away beat it or there was another movie in between it, but yeah, nothing apparently has surpassed Spirited Away in Japan specifically.
I love Mononoke too. I think those three are the three. But
yeah. I think for me, the three would be Spirited Away, Mononoke, and The Wind Rises. Although I also saw The Wind Rises just this week, so it's definitely like a fresh favorite.
Sure.
Yeah, for me, my Miyazaki history, I definitely, I think I'm less, or it, it it played less of a role for me than it sounds like it did for you. I know I had probably the first one I ever saw was when I was on a RV trip in Alaska with my family. We had there was a little TV in the RV, and there was two VHSs in there. One was Kiki's Delivery Service, and the other one was the Wild Thornberrys movie. And so we watched those a ton. And I really, really liked Kiki from watching it then. And then never really watched it until earlier in quarantine was the first time I had rewatched it since, I guess that would have been like fourth grade or something like that. But like it had sort of stayed burned in my head from watching it, presumably like seven times over the course of a week.
I gotta rewatch it. There's a lot of them that I have to rewatch that like rubbed me wrong for purely contextual reasons of like where I was watching them. Like Kiki's Delivery Service, the first time I watched it was there was this girl who I was like kind of hooking up with at the time, and then I ended it and it was like sour memories. So I didn't pay attention to Kiki's Delivery Service for most of it, and I just remember not liking it. So I feel like I need to give it another try though.
Yeah, I recommend it. I like it. It's not sort of my top tier one, but it's like, I mean, as we'll get to when we talk about all these movies, like every Miyazaki movie that I've seen is like at least an A. And it's the question of like which ones are the ones that are like transcendent, some of the best movies I've ever seen of all time versus incredibly good movies. Kiki's is more sort of in the middle for me. Same with like Nausicaa of like these are very, very good movies. They just aren't quite at that same level of like Spirited Away, Mononoke, Wind Rises. You know,
I definitely rate Nausicaa higher on the list for me because there's just so many. I just love the scenes of nature in there are just so entirely capture this like sense of grandeur and silence.
Yeah, definitely. But so I watched Kiki on an RV trip, and then Spirited Away is the only other one before the last year or so that I had ever watched. We had it at home. I know I'd watched it a couple of times when I was growing up, and I think I watched it again in high school or so. But I had seen it, hadn't really seen it since high school until last year. Blank Check, which is my favorite podcast of all time, they do series on different directors, and so they did a series on Miyazaki last summer. And in that, I watched Totoro for the first time, which I really liked. It's still sort of lower on my list me, but it's like, yeah, this is a really fun movie. Again, A as opposed to A plus. And then rewatched Spirited Away, and on rewatching Spirited Away, was like, oh, this movie's a masterpiece. Got it. It's not just that movie that I liked when I was a kid or I had in the back of my head when I was a kid. It's like, this is, oh, it's just, it's one of the best movies ever made. With HBO Max came out earlier in the beginning of quarantine. It's the first time that any of the Miyazaki movies have been available on streaming. Despite him saying for years and years, he's like, I will never allow any of these movies to go up on streaming. And then turns out, actually, nope, it's fine for HBO Max. I think this is also sort of why I suggested, hey, maybe we do a Ghibli episode, and then you're the one who picked Howl's Moving Castle.
Yeah.
So I rewatched Kiki and then watched Mononoke. And then similarly, as with watching Spirited Away, I was like, oh, this is all I'm going to think about for a week, huh? This movie's just going to burn in my head. And then that had been all until we get to this week when I watched Howl's Moving Castle and then watched, I still haven't seen every Miyazaki movie. Sure. Eight Up Club Bingo, I watched like four times as much as I needed to for this episode. But I watched Howl, Nausicaa, The Wind Rises, and Ponyo all for the first time in the last 2 weeks or so.
I think I saw Ponyo once and I was let down.
Yeah, I liked it. Again, all of these are A's, but I think that's my least favorite of all of them. It is the one that is the most, I mean, along with Totoro, I guess, the most clearly, it's a kid's movie. There's just enough Miyazaki weirdness to it, I guess, for lack of a better word, that I'm like, oh, this was another one that I watched in the dub instead of watching the subtitle version. But it's like, oh, when this weird fish girl is turning into, like, growing her own, like, set of chicken hands and chicken feet and trying to become a human, you know, she's being surrounded by all her fish sisters, looks at herself in the mirror, opens her mouth, and just screams, teeth, because she has teeth. And little stuff like that I was like, this movie's too fucking weird to be an actual kids movie. I mean,
bonkers.
And so I definitely like appreciated and liked that a lot. Also Ponyo Loves Ham, which you gotta respect.
Sure.
But yeah, that trio of it seems to me, if I look at the arc of all of the Miyazaki movies, I lean towards the little bit more adult ones, the ones that are a little bit more like, what's the word for it? The ones that are sort of more like the dark side of magic and the scary parts of magic, but mixed with the wonder and the beauty that comes with the scary parts, especially like Spirited Away and Mononoke, especially Mononoke with its like fucking Lovecraftian nightmare fuel, which I'm big on. And the stuff that's a little more not kid friendly, but like a little more childlike, is, you know, again, A instead of A+.
Yeah, that's fair. I definitely think I lean more towards like just the bewilderment and the different kind of worlds and such. And yeah, like I love Spirited Away, and I love the different world that's there and the magic that they use and all that sort of stuff. And like Porco Rosso, for example, like a really fun movie, but it's not, it's honestly just like a normal movie, except the main character is a pig.
Yeah.
And like, that's the only Miyazaki thing about it at all. Which is like, it's a great movie for sure, but it's just not like in this interesting, crazy fantasy world with full magic and wonderment and weird shit going down.
Yeah, that and Castle in the Sky are my two that I need to.
Castle in the Sky is good. It's pretty rough, I'd say. It's definitely like, this was his first movie, and
first Ghibli movie.
Yeah, and I don't want to spoil too much about it, but story's not too great in it.
Anything else on Miyazaki overall before getting into Howl a little bit more?
I think there's just kind of as like a society talking about Miyazaki, and like it's definitely seen as more of a art than a lot more other animated films are, which I think is awesome. And it has this own like there's animated movies and then there's Miyazaki films, you know, they function differently.
Yeah. And I think some of that is that there aren't, or I guess it feels like there hasn't been since like the days of really like Walt Disney and then moving into Chuck Jones for the like Looney Tunes stuff, where there feels like there's a single creative voice attached to animated movies. Like if you think of all the other Disney movies, it's like, who the fuck is the director of The Little Mermaid? I know because I'm a giant Disney nerd, but like real people don't know that.
No,
versus like Miyazaki, there is this sense of it being a work that springs from the mind of a specific person, both because it did, and he definitely has like a very exacting style and you know, created an entire movie studio so that him and Takahata would be able to like do that and act as, in the same way that you often see for directors of live action stuff, then be able to be the auteurs of their animated work in the way that doesn't really happen for a lot of other animated stuff. But I think also some of it is definitely like brand building of like, there's been enough of this legend and myth around Miyazaki that is definitely built on the reality of how he works and how controlling and singularly focused he is on his, on the stuff that he creates.
Yeah.
But definitely some of it is also that like, you know, we love the story of an artist, of the auteur. And also part of it is that like his movies are fucking weird. They're really strange movies, in a way that is like seemingly anti-commercial. And admittedly, in the case of the United States, like none of his movies have made more than like 3 or 4 million at the US box office. Most of them never even got wide releases. It's basically all understanding of him in the US comes from home video.
So New York has, it has a summer film festival that every like Friday or Saturday they put on a different Miyazaki film for like 2 or 3 months straight. And I had always wanted to go, and I finally got tickets, and I saw Nausicaa Valley in the Wind in theaters, and it was like, this is
damn.
And that also, of all the movies to see in theaters, I think that was either that one or Howl's, honestly, would have been pretty good.
Yeah. But yeah, I think you're definitely hitting on something of like, these movies feel artistic in a way that probably, probably the closest thing, though I think it's still a far cry from it in terms of like Western animation and Western movie making, is kind of the, or the kind of the cult of Pixar, especially earlier in the 2000s. I think there was a little bit of that around, that feeling of like, oh, this is the place that makes like the artistic animated movies, or these are the ones that are great for kids and adults. And yeah, there was a sense of them being tied to not necessarily a single creator, because they would, different people would direct all of them, but tied to a specific production house in the case of Pixar. But even then, it's not on the level of Miyazaki. And part of it probably also is the fact that, like, you know, we all discovered these by watching them on VHSs and DVDs or stuff growing up, and it feels a little more outsidery to U.S. audiences, at least. I wonder what it would be like in Japan, where, again, Spirited Away is apparently the highest grossing film ever in Japan. So
yeah,
maybe there's a different conception of him as more mass market.
Sure.
There.
Cool. So I guess now we've talked about Miyazaki for a bit, do you want to get into talking about the actual film?
Yeah. So I guess in terms of overall thoughts of the film, it sounds like for you, it's your favorite or tied for favorite. You really, yep, really like this movie. For me, this, I think, is one of the A's, not A pluses for me. I think Ponyo is my least favorite. This might be either this or Totoro is probably my second to least favorite. Grading on a giant curve. I didn't love it as much as some of the other movies that I watched last week, especially like Nausicaa and Wind Rises.
I mean, I respect it. And like, I definitely would say this is one of, if not my favorites, due to very personal reasons and very like just not identifying with the characters, but loving the world it's in that is very specific to me.
And yeah,
stuff like that for me, so I can understand.
Get into that. I'm actually really curious about that.
Well, it's something that I haven't shared before. It's just, you know, magic and like how my obsession with magic and how like this for me was Harry Potter before Harry Potter. Like,
interesting
in terms of the whimsy and magic that is done throughout the film and the. Just the ease of magic of, I love those worlds where magic is everywhere and magic is this integral thing to how you interact with the world around you, and I think this movie did that really well, especially considering like, I mean, there's a little bit of spoilers, but like you learn about the world of magic and people doing magic kind of along with the main character and along with that, like, she is ignorant to it for the most part and, you know, learns about it at the same pace as you do. Yeah, I'd say this was Harry Potter to me before Harry Potter was.
Nice. Yeah, I think I agree with that. And again, I'll say it over and over across the episode. It's a forced 4 out of 5 star movie for me. I still really, really like it more than most other movies I've seen. I think for me, that discussion around the magic part is sort of clarifying in why I don't resonate with it as much as some of the other Miyazaki movies. And I think that whimsy part of it is a big part of it. Because yeah, I'm thinking of like, particularly the two movies that I really, really love are Spirited Away and Mononoke, which are both movies where magic is similarly suffused into everything that happens.
Yeah.
And more so in the case of Spirited Away, there is the similar like sense of discovery as you, along with the main character, are learning about the rules of this magic world. Spirited Away actually arguably even more aggressively because she's a modern girl who's going into this magical,
yeah,
world, Alice in Wonderland-y. In the case of both of those two, in a way that's definitely very different from Howl, that the magic in Spirited Away, and especially Mononoke, it's very rarely whimsical. It's often, yeah, really fucking scary. Or if it's not scary, it's like otherworldly and alien. And like maybe you realize that it's actually beautiful and sweet, but like you're always still kind of want to hold it a little bit at edge. And I think that's a version of magic that really, really like aesthetically, and as I think of stories with magic, those are the ones that I gravitate to more.
Yeah.
Are these ones where it's like magic is powerful but frequently unknown and can really easily go awry and fuck you up if you're not careful with it. You know, and I think if Howl's Moving Castle was the same movie made by someone else and I wasn't comparing it to some of these other movies, then I would feel like, hell yeah, this is a great movie. And now I'm like, hell yeah, this is a great movie. It's just, I know in the back of my head, there's these other ones that I like a little bit more because they do stuff that's more aesthetically, I'm more of an aesthetic fan of.
This movie definitely has obviously that dark, it has some darker elements to it, but those are just not the darkness is often a more minor part, you know, of this film.
Yeah, it's like there's moments of darkness as opposed to darkness being suffused into every fiber of the movie's being in the way that it is for those two.
I'd say more Mononoke than...
More Mononoke, yeah. I guess Spirited Away more it's everything is dark and scary until you learn that it's actually really beautiful but still a little bit scary. Whereas Mononoke is like, oh shit, we are on the precipice of apocalypse by giant deer demon god thing.
Which is also interesting that, like, now that I'm saying these things out loud, by the way, it's like I'm in a D&D campaign because I'm a huge nerd, obviously. We're talking about Miyazaki on a podcast right now. But in this D&D campaign, I am a wild magic sorcerer, which what that means is, I got my sorcerer's powers from some ethereal being, and the wild magic part about it is, like, really chaotic. And I'm realizing, like, I'm not exactly perfectly modeled after Howl, but there's certainly some elements of Howl and how he uses magic and how he reacts to the world, at least certainly during closer to the beginning of the movie that my character like definitely has a little bit in common with, which is cool. I keep realizing these things about my character in D&D and how they relate to my life, and I'm like, oh, that's, I don't know if I did that subconsciously or coincidentally, but I'll pretend it was subconsciously, you know?
That's so cool. That's so cool. Yeah, especially for those that stuff that's like you're coming up with stuff in the heat of the moment and then back learning that like, oh, yeah, of course, this is going to be the product of 26 years of influences.
Yeah.
And actually related to, I guess, another thing around Miyazaki, I have, especially now that I've seen in the last year or so, seen more than just two of his movies. I have never seen a filmmaker, maybe with the exception of this one horror filmmaker named Mike Flanagan, who I like, who has such common themes and preoccupations across all of his different movies and is like consistently thinking about and exploring the same ideas or different takes on the same idea.
Yeah. And I mean,
really interesting.
He also has usually the same like character, like female lead protagonist who is thrown into a chaotic situation and has to make do or something. I don't really know what, but I'm sure there's a better way of saying that, but
yeah. Okay. Related to that, Howl's Moving Castle. I guess from this point we'll spoil stuff because we're also half an hour into this already and haven't talked about the plot of the movie. It's like a real blank check episode. So we open with, or very early get to, Sophie, who is our version of the spunky young female protagonist, Chihiro's.
She's not spunky.
Well, yeah, sure.
She is notably, definably meant to be an old maid who is young and like.
Okay, yes, that's true. That is a fair point. But she makes hats. She is sort of the contented is the wrong word, but she's like the older sister working in the hat shop.
Accepting,
yes.
Of her job and her life that she's leading.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so what do you think, actually, maybe on that? How do you feel about Sophie as a main character?
I mean, this is what started me into like having questions and doubts about how much I held this movie in high esteem in terms of some of the relationships of like, oh, there's this girl who lives a boring life and then this man just kind of pops. So eventually what happens is she meets Howl after she's getting like hit on by these soldiers who, you know, might have started to do some shittier shit. We don't know. And then, you know, this man comes in to save the day and to make her life exciting and full of passion and energy now. But I think I was thinking in too much into that and too much into like, oh, this is an old movie. How can I critique it from a woke, liberal, progressive perspective?
Yeah.
But I'm not sure. What do you think?
Yeah, that's interesting. So I think another piece of context about this movie is that it's based on a book, unlike some of the other Miyazaki movies that are original. But it's based on a book, also called Howl's Moving Castle, written by a British author named, let's look on Wikipedia, Diana Wynne Jones, who I've never heard of her. But if I look at her Wikipedia page, she looks like she's written a lot of stuff.
Okay.
None of which rings any bells as I skim, but cool. So I've not actually read the book, Howl's Moving Castle, but I've read the Wikipedia page for the movie, and I've listened to the Blank Check episode that talks about this a little bit. I also don't think any of those hosts had read the book either, so I guess we're all going off the same Wikipedia pages. It apparently is more of a more focused around being a sort of subversion of fairy tale tropes, and more around particularly trying to subvert them, again, reading from Wikipedia, more focused on the lens of like gender and class, and how do we play with that in the context of like, all right, we'll set this up to look like this big grand sweeping fairy tale.
Yeah.
And then we'll, turns out that actually the awesome cool wizard is kind of a womanizing jerk. And actually the, dealing more with sort of those sorts of lenses in a way that Miyazaki by and large ignores for some of his other preoccupations in this movie, which I'll get to when we get to them, because I have some thoughts on some of them.
Yeah. And yeah, I at the end of the day don't think that this movie makes any huge egregious errors in terms of that whole shtick, but there are some moments of like he's just this wizard who gets everything he wants, and he's a womanizing jerk.
So Sophie gets turned into an old woman when she meets the Witch of the Wastes, who is this antagonist figure, it seems. But she gets turned into an old woman and goes off to I'm trying to remember, is there a reason that she goes off into the wilderness, or is she just like, I just gotta go off and find something? Or does she already know at that point she wants to try and find the mysterious wizard?
She doesn't. So she just goes off. I think she just goes off because she's like, no one's going to accept me here. I have no family here anymore because no one's going to accept me for being this old woman. They won't believe me.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to leave and go out into the wastes and be alone. And I think she was possibly trying to go to the Witch of the Wastes and find her, but it was not clear.
But yeah, but she goes off. She runs into stealth MVP of this movie, my guy Turniphead, the scarecrow with a turnip for a head, who just sort of bounces around and leads her to the titular moving castle of Howl, which is this big, coolly designed sort of Baba Yaga chicken leg monstrosity, steampunk castle that wanders through the wilderness. And enters into it and meets two more characters for the rest of the movie. Markle, who is the young apprentice of Howl, who puts on a magic beard to pretend that he is a very high-voiced old man whenever he goes out and does business for Howl, which is one of those cool Miyazaki weirdnesses that I'm a big fan of. And then Calcifer, the fire demon.
Yes, who Calcifer in the dubbed English dubbed version is played by Billy Crystal, who, like, defines the character for me, so I'm still upset you haven't seen that version of it. And he's just this wise cracking fire demon who is basically keeps the fire going and also warms the house and makes the house move, and is super powerful throughout the film. Is a majority of the comedy relief, a la Billy Crystal. And
to the point of Miyazaki having a lot of tropes, well, both tropes and also the preoccupations and themes, stuff like that, but also one of the tropes, in the same way that there's often the young female protagonist, there is also the side character who could reasonably be voiced by Billy Crystal, particularly thinking of like Gigi in Kiki's Delivery Service, or some of the whoever's the name of the guy with all the arms in the coal firing room in Spirited Away. It's like, oh yeah, you could, there's a lot of these sorts of like wisecracking, probably magical side characters who kind of help be the introduction into the weird world of magic, but does it in what either is Billy Crystal's voice or could be Billy Crystal's voice if you recast.
Yeah. So after this scene, we also meet Howl really for the first, we met him before, but it was in this kind of, really super whimsical way of like, oh, he saves the girl from the two soldiers and then you know, they float and they walk around in the air for a bit before he whisks himself away. And then we kind of meet him, and in his house we see it's like a complete bachelor, not even a bachelor pad, like worse than bachelor pad, just utter filth everywhere is where he's living. And it's not something you'd expect of this like beautiful, pretty boy, powerful wizard.
Yeah, especially given how much the beautiful, pretty boy nature of it seems to be integral to the character. I don't remember if it's at this point or if it's later in the movie, but there is it was one of those moments that made me be like, oh, this is more interesting and more Miyazaki-y than what could at first blush be sort of a more just like, all right, this is a fun fantasy movie, yeah. Is the moment where like he has a complete freak out over something that Sophie does that, oh, it's
his hair.
So his hair gets dyed. Yeah.
She messed up his potions. Like she like reorganized them. And so he used the wrong one and his hair got dyed red. And he like starts freaking out and he starts slumping down in the chair and like summoning these demons of darkness everywhere. And his sludge starts coming off of his skin. It's honestly like,
yeah,
outside the context of him like messing up his hair, it would have been pretty terrifying. Like,
yeah,
it's a good scene.
Yeah, which it is. And it is interesting that like that in a lesser movie, it makes it that like the things that you would take for granted in another movie, oh, of course the magical wizard is going to be really pretty. It turns out like that's actually a plot point, and the plot point is that he's a needlessly vain man, and in a way that is in fact can be actually destructive at times.
Yeah,
which also seems very Miyazaki-esque to be like, oh, this vanity, you know, shame on you for being so, you know, putting so much energy into something as stupid as personal appearances.
Yeah, it also like really humanizes him, which I think is good.
Yeah,
because it makes him from this Dorian Gray type character. I mean, he still is a Dorian Gray type character.
It makes him more into the actual character of Dorian Gray rather than the persona that Dorian Gray puts on to other people.
Exactly. Yeah.
Related to that, actually, another thing in this movie that I really appreciated, and part of this is me cribbing from Blank Check, but I agree with it that like, in a lesser movie, like Sophie turns, so she gets cursed, she turns into an old woman. In a lesser movie or a more traditional movie, like it'd be like, oh my God, this is so bad. I hate this. I need to do everything that I can to solve it. And she'd be constantly fighting against it or like trying to convince people she's actually secretly young or stuff like that. And to your point earlier about like, she kind of already was an old woman, even when she was a young woman, she's mostly pretty chill with it. Like she does still want the curse to go away, but it's like she.
It's not her life goal.
Yeah, but she talks a lot about how it's actually really freeing for her to be able to be like, oh, I can kind of say what I want now. I can, you know, don't have to worry about some of these trappings of youth. And that's true even from the beginning, like even in those first, you get a sense that she's sort of growing into herself in an interesting way, especially in some of those earlier, in the conversation with Turnipet, actually, I think was sort of the first moment I noticed that is like, oh, you're leaning into this a lot more than I thought. I thought the movie was going to be about you trying to rail and struggle against this and try and get out of it.
Yeah.
When in reality, you're actually sort of like, you know, this is mostly okay.
Yeah.
There's and the rest of the movie becomes, especially after she meets Howl and gets more involved in Howl's shenanigans, becomes more about how do I help and save Howl than, you know, even at the beginning, there was the whole like her and Calcifer strike a deal to help reverse the curse or whatever. Like that basically is a non-entity for most of the rest of the movie. It's more about, hey, I'm basically okay being an old woman. How can I use this to help Howl or use my relationship with him or my knowledge to help Howl get over his self-destructive tendencies?
Yeah. It was about her finding her new life and finding her new home. Especially, it's something that I really liked about the movie was like, she didn't really have a home before. She didn't really have...
Yeah.
Like, she had her sister and her mother, but didn't really identify with them too well, and they didn't really feel... Like, there was a time when the mother came over explicitly to betray her.
Okay, good. I was going to ask, because that was reminding me of something, but I had to remember, like, did that happen in this movie, or was that in one of the other Miyazakis that I watched this week? But yes.
Yeah, she came over explicitly to betray her, to like plant a bug on her, to betray Howl, but in doing so betray her.
Yeah.
And her response, even before she found out she was betrayed, was like, well, at least she had the kindness, or she had, I don't know, the heart to actually come over and visit me. Which makes it clear that, like, this wasn't a family, even when she was young. And so, like, she didn't really have much to leave in the first place. So it was almost more like her becoming old was a blessing for her to go out and do something and to go out and live her own life.
Totally, totally. Which, again, it's that level of compassion, that level of sort of thinking thing, having that sort of that empathy for all the characters and thinking things one step further, is definitely very Miyazaki, and part of why I think we are saying, like, oh, you know, these movies feel artistic in a way that particularly animation, which in the West is made for mass audiences and made for kids in particular, often doesn't get to be. So then Sophie gets roped into, so there's a war going on between these two countries. Howl is apparently fighting on both sides of the war, or kind of just fucking up the war for people by turning into a bird.
Just destroying random bombing planes that are bombing villages kind of indiscriminately.
Yeah, and Sophie gets wrapped into that because apparently there's a summons that Howl can't finally is getting, you know, summoned at whatever level of summoning is too big to ignore. So she pretends to be his mom and goes to meet the king's advisor, I guess, which person? Suleiman.
And then this is kind of when we discover that, like, oh, like, this is, I feel like this is like the first real interaction with any authority and anything to do with the war, actually. And we discover that, like, war is bad, and this is kind of a theme throughout most of Miyazaki's films, is all war is bad. What's the point of war? And this is the character that represents the one who is battling.
Yep. Another sort of Miyazaki trope, this character of the, like, the adult woman who is powerful and is probably on the wrong side, but is more complicated than just being a black and white villain, I think. The Suleiman character is not as interesting as particularly Lady Eboshi in Mononoke, but very much sort of cut from a similar cloth. But yeah, very much like, you know, gets the sense that she's fighting the war to fight the war more so than because there's a point to, like, you know, for any sense of honor or military necessity or what have you. She also turns the Witch of the Waste into an old woman, or I guess removes her magic that keeps her looking young. And I
think also remove the demon that was inside of her.
Yes, that sounds right. While they're at there at the governor's mansion, king's mansion, whatever it would be, and then Howl and Sophie escape because Sophie stops Howl from turning into a bird monster.
Yeah. Because they were about to, because she is able to understand that it's going to be a trap and it's going to, you know, all his powers are going to be diffused.
Yep. Sorry, my cat is trying to climb on my leg, and normally I'm okay with it, but she is very much using her claws, which I'm not a fan of. So I'm going to try and get her to. There you go. Okay. Yes. Okay. Where are we? Castle
film when the Witch of the Waste is transferred back.
Which
I do want to talk about the Witch of the Waste for a bit of this character who is defined by her desire for Howl's heart, which I'm not sure if that was, like, Howl at one point did say that, like, oh, I used to love the Witch of the Waste, but then I realized she wasn't beautiful on the inside. She was a very mean, cruel person, so I ran from her. So there's this kind of sentiment of, like, women chasing him and him running, and that's her defining characteristic, is that she's pursuing Howl, which is, I don't know, not something that I liked.
I appreciated the, again, it being more interesting than your traditional fantasy story where, like, oh, this person that you thought was going to be the big antagonist is kind of just like a mostly harmless nuisance that hangs around with you for the rest of the movie and is just kind of funny and then occasionally fucks things up by kind of just, but still in a way that you're sort of like, oh, witch of the waste, of course you're going to try and steal Calcifer and stuff like that. But like, in a way that's mostly,
mostly comedic and harmless.
Exactly. But at the same time, I don't know, I appreciated that move, but I guess, spoiler, overall, I don't love the back half of the movie as much as I like the beginning of it, for, fair, I think, a variety of reasons.
I agree, especially the ending.
Yeah. and I think The Witch of the Waste is a little bit indicative of that, of like, once that turn happens, and once we get through the first couple scenes of her being like, oh yeah, she's just sort of the fun hanger-on, it's like, okay, and then she's just there.
Yeah, all right. It is a bit odd.
And then she steals Calcifer. But then they get her back, and then she's just there. Then they manage to escape. Oh, there is the cool part. So over the course of the movie, there's like these four different doors that you can use that all go into Howl's thing, but they're like in different towns and stuff like that. And then there's a sequence where soldiers are breaking down the doors of all the different aliases of Howl's that are in these various towns, and they break through, and what do they find? Empty abandoned courtyards and empty abandoned buildings. It's because
very cool use of magic. And there was like, so when he did this cool magic to like transport them, and he happened to transport them to the town that Sophie grew up in and lived in, and all the doors and rooms, there's this really cool scene where they're all changing and magic stuff is happening. And also, I think this is, that for me at least, was kind of the defining moment of Howl showing affection for Sophie in a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
Not only because, you know, he got her his own private getaway and stuff, but just like, oh, you know who this person is. You know that she's not this old lady, that this is the chick who you glided down to the rooftop that one time.
Ooh, that's true. I had never thought of that before.
Yeah. Yeah. Because how else would he – he never mentions it, but
But yeah, then they're in the – in Sophie's town, which gets attacked by the bombers and gets blown up.
The town finally.
While I did say that, like, overall, I think I don't love the back half of the movie as much as the front half, there are a couple sequences and scenes that I do really, really like. One of them is this bombing. And I think, so an overall thing that I felt watching the movie that then it turns out makes sense in retrospect was the thing of like, I don't know how I feel about the war plot combined with the rest of the movie, that it kind of feels like there's two movies happening at once that are sort of stitched together and you know, work together but don't work as well as a whole, especially again in contrast to in the back of the result, but also in again, if I was watching this and it wasn't by a guy named Hayao Miyazaki, or we pretended it was by someone else, I wouldn't be comparing it to Princess Mononoke or The Wind Rises, which are movies that I think are much, much more, the war parts of it are much more tied into and integrated throughout the entire movie in a way that this
feels
a little more bits and pieces.
It definitely feels like the inception of this movie was more for a love story with the war part kind of tacked on.
Yeah. That's incredibly interesting you say that, because the war plot is not a thing in the book, apparently. Or rather, it is mentioned as like, oh, these people are at war. There's two kingdoms are at war. But it's not like a big thing. Instead, do you want to know what ended up happening?
Sure.
Was a different person from Ghibli was supposed to make the movie. I have Mamoru Hosada, who did a bunch of Digimon and Dragon Ball Z and Sailor Moon. And then, for whatever reason that I don't fully know, I think there was just like some creative differences, and then ended up leaving the project. And then Miyazaki stepped in and was like, okay, fine, we'll restart this production. I'm going to direct it. And his big inspiration was, I want to make a movie about how much I hate the Iraq War. To the point where it's like he didn't accept his Spirited Away Academy Award win in person because he was like so mad at the U.S. for the Iraq War. So he was like, I'm going to make an anti-U.S., anti-Iraq War movie. It just so happened that the movie he decided to do that for was a book about this love story and about that where the war is like a line item in the book, and then instead blows it up to be like the thematic structure of the back half of the movie and the preoccupation, which I think from my view, like when I was saying that I like that bombing sequence a lot, like that scene is a really distilled version of Miyazaki saying like the Iraq war is bad and then doing it in this one sequence, and it works really well. The problem though is more that like how does that tack on, so if I pull it apart as a scene in and of itself, I love it. How does it function within the rest of the movie, or how does this overall plot line function within the rest of the movie? That's where I think I'm a little more like, all right, it's an A as opposed to an A plus. Again, comparing it to Mononoke and The Wind Rises, which I think are similarly, or they're also anti-war movies because it's Miyazaki. Like I said before, Miyazaki, yeah, he has his preoccupations. It just does it much, much more elegantly than it does in this movie.
Yeah. Talking about this movie is making me like it less and less.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
I mean, the parts I still love about it are still beautiful in my head and like shimmering and especially like even the scene of like her going into the bathroom and it being kind of disgusting, but also kind of like entrancing and mystical in its own right. But yeah, thinking about the story of it and the tacking on of it is making me like that part less of it. But I still really like, you know, the character of Howell and how he's developed, the character of Sophie and how she interacts with this part of the romance that I feel between the two of them is, and I don't know too much about Pride and Prejudice, but for some reason it reminds me of that romance.
Interesting. Interesting. Huh.
Maybe only she does.
Okay. Yeah. Because she definitely is like, she can give as good as she can take. And in fact, doesn't really take at all over the course of this movie. Definitely like pushes back to Howell from the beginning in a way that's cool.
Yeah.
And I mean, it is related to that fact of Sophie, the movie having Sophie be very okay and in fact empowered by the fact that she's become an old woman. Even though it is technically what happens, this movie never places what would have been the way that they would have done it in a lesser movie of, oh, well, here's the thing. He has to fall in love with her because despite the fact that she's an old woman, it's like that almost never even comes up. And like they never put an emphasis on any of that part. It's just like this happens in a way that like feels natural and feels normal. And then she turns back into a young woman, but it's not meant to be like, and here is your reward for all this love and this selfless love, even though you fell in love with an old crone. It's like, no, it's just like, the movie happens. Sophie and Hal fall in love because they're Sophie and Hal.
Yeah, that was something that I really enjoyed that I thought me looking at this movie that 16-year-olds wasn't going to enjoy. Of just like the love story, like I feel like most love stories you can point to like here's the moment when she knew or like here's when she started to turn or whatever. And this, it was so much more subtle and indistinct and it just kind of happened.
Yeah.
But it didn't feel wrong or gross, I guess, as well. It's just like, they started to, you know, like she took care of him and he took care of her and it just kind of happened.
Yeah.
It was pretty.
Yeah. I like that. I like that. That makes sense. That makes sense.
I like that a lot.
And I mean, I am definitely someone who's a big fan of rom-coms and movies like that, but like in a lot of other movies, to your point, the actual structure of the movie is tied around these characters falling in love, so there is plot points around that falling in love because you're tying the two together, whereas in this case it's much more subtle
there are some points where it's obviously like it doesn't feel like it's a shift, but it's just a declaration of what it's at, if that makes sense. It's not like this scene is progressing their love. It's like this scene is where their love is at is what some of it felt like.
Yeah, I like that. I think that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And I think that's cool. So I think then bombing happens and they pull Calcifer out of the out of the castle, which then destroys the castle because he's the magic that's keeping it all afloat. And then there's this moment, this like inception like moment where Sophie starts like going into, I guess it's not a dream, it's like the past of Howl, yeah. In that like they're out in this wilderness and seeing the moment where Calcifer came down as a falling star.
And he like swallowed him to like put him in his heart, which I assume gives him a lot of power.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and he's like, she shouts out and is like, find me in the future. And I'm like, what's...
Yeah, yeah, it was interesting. And so this was the other, like, the two scenes that I really like that are in the back half, which are some of my favorite scenes in the movie, yeah. Are that bombing and then this, like, magic, you know, jumping nice. In the four layers deep in the dream and then riding the kick out.
I wish they had tied it in so much yes. more. Like, the issue with... like, they could have made, like, Howl having this knowing quality about Sophie throughout the whole movie instead of being just like a trait that he has towards everyone, being kind of aloof and a little bit haughty and know-it-all about things. He could have known Sophie was from his past and like known that this was a special person.
Yeah.
Instead of over the course of the movie, like you do see him fall in love with her, but he like discovers his love and he's like, she's just there one day and he's like, he's rolling with the punches. He's not, I couldn't imagine knowing that final end bits about going into the past. I can't trace that back throughout the rest of the movie through his actions.
Yes, this is no Arrival. It is not a big like, all of this now makes sense because of this timey-wimey shenanigans. Yeah,
could have been,
I agree.
So good.
Yes, and yeah, similar to the bombing scene, it's like really, really great scene that I think more extreme in this case. Maybe what I would say is that it tonally and emotionally fits in really nicely with the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
And especially as the like the clicking and understanding of, this is how, or even better way of phrasing it, that scene serves really well to solve the puzzle of Calcifer and Howl.
Yeah.
It then also introduces the puzzle of Sophie time traveling and being in Howl's head from that extremely important moment. That then is not paid off in any way. So it like solves one problem, but then raises another one.
Which is frustrating.
Yeah. But then she comes back and gets the heart back from the witch and places it inside of Howl. And then voila, magic happens. Calcifer is no longer bound to Howl, but then does stick around anyway because he's cool.
Yeah. And, you know, Howl is saved and loves Sophie. And this, I don't know how I feel about the end of the movie in general and just how it all resolves just kind of like in a snap.
Yeah.
And then she kisses Turnip Head because he happened to, you know, save them from their precipitous fall down the side of a mountain and he's almost dead. And she's like, we'll get you a new stick. It'll be fine. So she kisses him, and then he turns into the prince of the warring kingdom that has been missing and is the cause of war.
I loved that. On the one hand, it's very indicative, I think, that like the whole war plot being weirdly like shoved into this movie that in a way it didn't need to be. And especially, again, reading from the Wikipedia page about the differences between the book and the novel. In the novel, it's much more of the Prince Justin is missing. The Prince Justin is missing. That's a thread that runs throughout the entire thing. And then that sort of sets up this being the end, that it's like, guess what? Turnip Head is actually the prince. In a way that it is completely not set up at any point in this movie. Like, I think maybe literally there is one sentence somewhere earlier in the movie that like, the prince is missing.
And I think that was supposed to be the impetus of the war, like the fact that the prince was missing. And like, that was not super clear.
Yep.
But in the end, that was what resolved it. So it was like, I guess that's why they were at war, was because the prince was missing.
Yeah.
What you learned right now.
Yeah. On the other hand, I do love, as just a weird Miyazaki thing, like that as just like, this happens too. All right.
Yeah.
So it's like, on the one hand, I don't love that it's not tied into anything, especially when it could have been. But on the other hand, I love that it's not tied into anything. And it's just like, this foppish prince character pops up and it's like, it's me, I'm the prince, you're my true love. Oh, you're in love with this other person? All right, I'll stop the war. Bye.
I do love that. And also I love it in the context of what you were talking about before at the very beginning about like subverting expectations of yes. the fairy tale, and how she's like kisses him and then immediately is like focused on how, and it's like sad and upsetting for him, but he's like, he's, but also very good model for being rejected, by the way.
Yes. Guys. Hey guys out there, be yeah. like Turnipad. Be yeah. like Turnipad. Look up. This guy knows what's up.
Also, I do another fun Miyazaki thing is him. I don't know if you noticed this, but him leaving was on a stick, still yep. jumping.
Yeah.
Like he had Turnipad's magic still, basically. It was like, okay, cool.
Turnipad, our woke bae. I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It definitely feels like, it feels more like, oh, this is a thing that has to happen. All right, fine. Rather than it, like, to the point about the, like, subverting the fairy tale expectation. It's like, yeah. I guess in the fairy tale, you kiss the scarecrow and it turns into a person who's also a prince. All right, fine. We'll yeah. make that happen. And then he'll go pogo stick away.
Yeah, and it was just the end of the movie, and it was like, we need to resolve everything right now. Yeah. And so then, oh, Solomon sees through her seeing eye dog, who just checks in with her, which, by the way, he was there the entire time, another random comedic character.
Yeah. Which also extremely Miyazaki trope of the like, oh, it's the magical character who doesn't talk of the villain, but then hangs out with the good guys and decides to be the good guy. That is like, yep, Miyazaki. He knows what he likes.
Yep. It was just kind of a serendipitous end to the movie, and just like everything just stopped all at once. It's like, okay.
Yeah.
That's fine. But I did love, you know, the final ending scene where the castle is rebuilt, except now it's in the sky. They have like a little yard, and you know, Sophie and Hal are together, and Sophie is her younger self, you know, except with gray hair, and like,
yeah,
she's, yeah, that also, I think that would be a very interesting relationship of like, if your significant other, every time they're angry and upset, turned into an old person, and you'd be like, I'm not angry. It's like, I mean, you say that, but
it's true. It's true. Yeah, that could be beneficial. Not having your tells.
Yeah, so literal. And
yeah. So, overall thoughts on Howl's Moving Castle, the 2004 movie by Miyazaki.
So I think this is the first time I've ever revisited it with a critical eye in my head. So I still think it is one of my favorites. I think after this discussion, honestly, it did lower it down in my head, unfortunately.
That's kind of a bummer.
Yeah,
I kind of feel bad about that, despite the fact that you're bringing it more down to the level that I've been arguing for. Not arguing for, but explaining my thought processes for over the last hour.
I mean, it's what it's transformed into is, instead of this, like, really fun movie from my childhood, like the aspects of it, it's still that, but just the aspects of it that are that have changed or have specified, and like, it's no longer about the story in my head, which is kind of here hit or miss throughout the, as we talked about, but it is definitely more about the character of Howl, the character of Calcifer, the character of Sophie, and also all the magical images and the uses of magic and the whimsy that surrounds a lot of the film. That's, I think, what I love more about it. And I think that, like, I'll always hold those things near and dear to my heart. Yeah. So, like, that's what I cherish it more for. I think of this less now as my favorite piece of art and more as, like, beautiful characters, eye candy and whimsy and nostalgia. As opposed to like Spirited Away, if I go back and watch it again, it'll be the things that I just described for Howl's, but also a almost note for note perfect movie.
Nice. That is a very good summation. Yeah, I think for me, this has been a really good discussion and has been a lot of like reminding me about stuff that I, especially it did remind me of a lot of stuff that I really liked, because I think particularly because I didn't love this movie as much as you did, I think I sort of brought a lot of the negative stuff to the table. So I had already had that in my head, but it was good to sort of be reminded of random stuff that I like. I do think it is still not, it is still one of my least favorite Miyazaki movies. It hasn't really gone up or down in my ranking, because of course I have a ranking on Letterboxd, because duh,
of course.
It's me. But it hasn't really moved in my ranking through this discussion, but it definitely has been a valuable clarification and a reminder of the fact that, like, I really liked watching this movie. Like,
yeah,
this was fun. It was a good way to spend 2 hours. It is a movie that has a lot of images and stuff that's in my head now and will be for forever.
Yeah. That's what it's turned into for me. It's like a fun, joyful thing in my head now.
Yeah. And it was also a good impetus to burn through more of the Miyazaki back catalog that I hadn't watched before, which I am very greatly thankful for, especially seeing Nausicaa and the Wind Rises, which I really loved. But yeah, I mean, I think it's a shame that so much of my opinion of it is colored by comparing it to other works of art,
sure,
that I think are better and I like more from the same artist, when, you know, just like, it's a shame that I'm not able to separate those. I think, though, a big part of it is the fact that, you know, one, that's just, again, I made a ranking. Of course, that's the way I'm going to do things. That's the way my brain works when I think, yeah, about artistic stuff, for better and for worse. A lot of my qualms with the movies are qualms specifically, well, I don't know if they're qualms because of this or not, but they're qualms that are done better in other movies by him. The anti-war thing feeling really tacked on, it stands out more because he has movies where that is the central thrust, and it's so beautifully, elegantly done,
yeah,
even in an allegorical movie like Princess Mononoke. And the fact that, like, the magic is really cool, but I prefer the magic in Spirited Away and Mononoke. And that everything that I brush up against it is magnified by the fact that, oh, he also made these masterpieces that do all of this and more. And I saw those masterpieces first. Maybe it would be different if I first had watched Howl's Moving Castle and then progressed to other movies. So on one hand, it feels a little bit unfair to lay that at this movie's feet. And maybe if it was the same movie in the context of a different creator, I would feel differently. I still don't think it would be above, like, again, a 4 out of 5 movie, which is still incredibly good. I basically am in the same spot that I was before this conversation, but this was a good clarifier and a reminder of, yeah, the stuff that I really liked about it.
That's good. I'm glad.
And thank you for recommending this movie.
It's fun.
And it's good to... it is interestingly... Spirited Away is definitely far and away the most popular Miyazaki movie, but, like, I feel like this, if I'm thinking through conversations with, you know, kids growing up for a decade or plus, I was always saying, like, oh yeah, I've only ever seen Kiki and Spirited Away.
Sure.
And people would be like, oh, you mean you haven't seen blah blah blah? Almost always they would say, you haven't seen Howl's Moving Castle, and maybe to a lesser extent
Totoro.
It sort of felt like it was like Spirited Away, and then right below that would be like Howl's Moving Castle, Totoro, Kiki.
Yeah.
Well-known popular ones. Which, again, I guess makes sense given that, like, mostly we're talking to people of our age and generation who grew up watching them on VHSs, sure, in elementary, middle, and high school.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's an interesting thought. I wonder, and I kind of want to ask my sister at some point, I know for Harry Potter, we are smack dab in, like, the one generation. Like, other kids have read and enjoy Harry Potter, but we are in the Harry Potter generation where it was, like, every single person knows Harry Potter. Everyone has read it. Everyone has dressed up as Harry Potter for a Harry Potter character for Halloween at least once. Like, we are 3 years on either side of us is, like, the Harry Potter generation.
For sure.
In a way that my sister has never, like, she read 2 of the books and never went past that. I would be curious if that is also the case for Ghibli movies, either for people older than us or people younger than us. In us, like, they were available for us when we were growing up and we were kids, but we didn't have Netflix yet and weren't watching, like, literally whatever we want whenever.
For sure. That's weird.
I wonder.
I don't know. That's hard.
Yeah, I have no idea. I'll ask my sister at some point, like, hey, have you seen the Miyazaki movies? I could also, on the other hand, see it being the thing that, like, yeah, these are all out and, like, kids fucking love these movies. They're great. And so it could be the thing that's like, no, in fact, they love them and are even more obsessed with them than we were.
Yeah. Yeah, they're weird in a good way.
Good movies. Still need to see Porco Rosso and Castle in the Sky.
Both pretty good ones. Yeah, for sure.
Yep. And you need to see The Wind Rises because I don't want to hype it up too much, but it's very good.
That's like the most new one, I'm pretty sure.
Yes, right? That's the most recent one. It was going to be his last movie, or he said he was going to retire afterwards, and then like 2 years after it came out, unretired and started working on another movie.
Of course. I think that's all I got.
Nice, nice. Same here. If you have opinions on the films of Hayao Miyazaki, then you can let us know about those in all sorts of manner of places, whether that's our email address at theawclub@gmail.club. I keep saying that, gmail.club. theawclub@gmail.com. That's theawclub@gmail.com. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter at theawclub. That's at theawclub. If you want to subscribe to this podcast or want to send it to a friend, you can find it wherever podcasts are found, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, all that good stuff. You can also go to our website, theadub.club. That's theadub.club, where you can find our topics guide, which is the list of all the different things we've talked about that you can click on, and it'll link out to episodes. Ooh, and surprise, I didn't tell you about this. I also set up a starter guide page for if you want to start with the podcast and want to pick any of the ones that we think are good, fun episodes to start with, because you kept keep asking me about that, and I keep having friends that are like, oh, you have a podcast, why don't I listen to it? And then I have to figure out something to send to them, and then they listen to it and never listen to it again. So let me remember. I have a couple, but I'm also interested in your takes, Alex Wade, about what else should be on there. I know I put our Buffy episode on because I thought that was very good and I liked it. And I needed some justification for the fact that I spent 2 months doing nothing but watching Buffy.
Sure.
I have our first episode, the time travel one. Yes. I have our Can You Like Good Art from Shitty People episode.
Yes.
I have our Detective Pikachu episode, and I have our Buffy the Vampire Slayer
okay.
episode. Any other ones you can think of that are good to throw on the pile?
Nothing pops to the top of my head. I was going to say time travel, but that was the first one.
Yep.
Yeah.
See, time travel. It's. I don't know. I was gonna make a joke, and then we're an hour and 16 minutes into this. Oh, we're an hour and 30 into it. God damn. All right.
Yeah.
Fun. Whew, boy, this is a good one. This will be exciting. Other thing. Pause to talk. No, in fact, I'm not gonna pause because that's more things that I need to cut out. Never mind. This is the end of the episode.
Hit up club out.
Hit up club out.
So much, yeah, I like that a lot more than, I guess, there's a lot of rom-coms because they just seem, I don't know, I haven't seen The Notebook, but I saw one clip of it, of like the first moments where he met her or something, and he starts hanging from this Ferris wheel, and I'm like, what the fuck are you doing, man? You're like, you're threatening to kill yourself unless she goes out with you, and I'm like, what
seems not the move.
Yeah. What kind of fucked up thing is this? And then she like takes his pants down. And I'm like, I guess you got your revenge, but you're still going out on a date with this fucking asshole. I don't know. And especially, I also consider who plays the guy in Notebook?
Ryan Gosling.
Yeah, Ryan Gosling. I feel like could play a version of Howell, a bit too gruff.
Yeah,
and not enough pretty boy, but. He's closer to it.
Christian Bale is the voice of Hal in the dub.
Oh my God. Really?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. I see that. Which
Young Christian Bale? Young Christian Bale totally would see. Young, not in his like scary machinist 94 pounds shenanigans, but like Christian Bale in like slightly less bulked up Bruce Wayne mode. Yeah, that would work. Or actually, no, in like American Psycho, but not covered in blood.
I mean,
mode.
I think of American Psycho. I don't know. He's the problem with is American Psycho. My image of young Christian Bale is American Psycho, which is like this very bland businessman person, who is, you know, perfect in a lot of physical ways, but not flamboyant and doesn't have style or that kind of laissez-faire charm.
Yeah, but put him in a cape. See what happens.
I'd be like, what the fuck is Christian Bale doing in a cape?
Yeah, fair. Pre-Batman.
Who would be this character?
Who would be this? Timothée Chalamet could do it.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a little young and a little waifish, but...
Justin looks alone, yes. I don't know much about his acting. And he seems a bit, in my image, a bit too shy, but I don't really know him too well, frankly.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, the guy who played, whoever played Dorian Gray in Penny Dreadful.
Oh, right. I should start watching Penny Dreadful.
Oh, I got it. First off, yes, you should. And I think there's a new series out. Secondly, what's his name? Blonde, Game of Thrones, sexy. Man.
Jamie Lannister?
Lannister.
Nikolai Walder or something or another.
That's who I'd cast.
Nice. Okay. Yeah, I could see it.
He's a bit too...
Reeve Carney is Dorian Gray. Oh, right. Yeah. Orpheus himself.
I mean, wow. Dorian Gray is basically a version of Howl.
Like... Yeah, totally. Oh, God. Yeah. I keep forgetting that Reeve Carney was in Penny Dreadful.
Yeah.
Oh, and he was Spider-Man in the Spider-Man musical.
Well, you haven't seen it, though, so...
Penny Dreadful? No, I watched the first two seasons of Penny Dreadful. I just never finished it.
Oh, the last season's pretty good.
Yeah.
And I also, this is so off topic right now, but I didn't know that the third season was ending. Like, I'd watched these all in series. Like, oh, I'm ready to start the fourth season. Years after it ended, apparently. And as I was on the final, like, one or two episodes, some, like, crazy shit was happening that only happens, you know, at a series ending, obviously. And I was like, what? This thing is going off the rails. Like, how are they going to come back from this? And then I got to the end and was like, oh, they're not. Damn.
Yeah. Yeah, I should watch it. I'll get back to it. I've been watching the Harley Quinn cartoon, also on HBO Max, which is so fucking good. But I've been parceling it out because I watched the whole first season in one night, and so I've been parceling out season two, like only doing one a day.
I gotta find something new to watch because like Buffy, for some reason, just feels like a chore.
What season are you on?
What?
What season?
I'm still
on
season three, like halfway through. Like,
okay.
Faith just betrayed them.
I was gonna say, if you're on season four, I can see why. but see, yeah, no, it's fair.